The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Blue Cliff Record, case number 98. Tianping's two wrongs. While on pilgrimage, Tianping visited Shi Yuan. He was always saying, "Don't say you've understood Buddhism. There's no one who can have a Dharma dialogue with me or examine me." One day, Shi Yuan saw him at a distance and called him. "Come here, Sun Yin." Tianping raised his head. Shi Yuan said, "Wrong." Tianping went on for two or three steps. Shi Yuan said, "Wrong." Tianping turned and came closer. Shi Yuan said, "I've just said wrong twice. Is it I who am wrong, or is it you?" "It's I." "Wrong." Tianping was silent. "Stay here for the summer retreat, and I'll examine this question of two wrongs with you." Tianping, however, departed. Years later, when Tianping became an abbot, he addressed his assembly and said, "Once in my days of pilgrimage, I visited Siouan by chance, and he twice said wrong. He advised me to stay with him for the summer retreat to examine this question of two wrongs with him. I don't say I was wrong then, but when I left for the South, I realized for the first time that I had finished saying wrong." So we don't know a lot about the two figures in this koan. Sometimes there's quite a backstory, as turned out at our last sesshin, but this time, very little. In fact, we don't even have birth and death dates for these two teachers, although we know what generation they were in. And when I say generation, I don't mean biological, but transmission generation. And they're quite separated that way. So Tianping Songyi, who's the one who's wandering, is from the 16th generation. And Shi Yuan, the older teacher he encounters, is from the 11th generation. So we can suppose that Tianping is rather young, and Shi Yuan is maybe in his 60s or even 70s. I'm guessing that Tianping is probably in his late 20s, early 30s. And the reason I'm guessing that is knowing a little bit about how teachers developed in ancient China. When you had some experience of realization and your teacher gave you some kind of approval, if not full transmission, maybe full transmission, then you went on wandering. You went out wandering. You went from place to place, which is what I believe here is being called pilgrimage. It's not called pilgrimage in other translations. So Tianping is going from place to place, encountering various teachers and testing his understanding. And the idea is testing and deepening the understanding, testing and deepening one's realization. I think Tianping is missing the deepening part here. He was always saying, "Don't say you understood Buddhism." This is his approach to what's called Dharma combat. "There's no one who can have a Dharma dialogue with me or examine me." Now, this makes him sound pretty jerky. And I think it's very easy to dismiss him at this point and just wait for him to get his comeuppance. We could read the koan that way. I worry
Alan,
about...
excuse me. Yeah. The mic needs to be a little bit closer to you.
Thank you, Pierce. How is this better? No?
Do we know that
this, it's... Does this need to be turned on?
It should be all set.
How about now, Pierce? Better?
Okay. Better still? Okay.
Thank you. So I'll start. No, I don't. were you able to hear the koan? Okay, good. So easy to dismiss him, but then I think that would be a failure in our compassionate understanding of this poem. It would be insufficiently charitable. So let's think about Tianping a little bit and where he may be coming from. I'm guessing again, and what's wonderful about having very little information on these teachers is that we can feel our way into it. And so I'm sharing my understanding as it's developing of the koan, not so that you can adopt it, but so that you'll be inspired to develop your understanding, which will be different from mine. And as I'm understanding the koan, Tianping is not stupid. He's probably very clever. And he seems to have grasped intellectually a lot of Chan teachings, of Chinese, of what would become Zen teachings. He probably has a good memory and has lots and lots of phrases he can pull out of his head in this or that Dharma encounter. And he seems to be good at just coming up with the right one that ends the discussion. In one translation, he says, there's no one who can come up with a phrase. So he's a person of phrases, of memorized sayings. I mentioned last night that the Chinese word xin, from which is derived sishing, touching the heart mind, the Chinese word xin does not separate heart and mind. But that doesn't mean that ancient Chinese people weren't perfectly capable of separating heart and mind, and weren't perfectly capable, as people are now, of having merely intellectual understandings of the teachings. Maybe not merely, but largely in Tianping's case. And favoring what I often call the school mind over the heart mind. That this was a time in China when there was a very rich, robust intellectual culture, and when education consisted of mastering the Confucian system largely through memorization and reading. So it's not out of the question that a Chinese person of this time who'd been educated in the way of his time would have been overly intellectual. And so kind of missing the point, right? Because what we're trying to do is get beyond our intellectual understanding of the teachings and to really feel our way into them with our hearts, with our heart mind, with our, I might even say with our heart and gut mind, as when we talk about gut reactions or something not being right with our gut. I don't feel that from Tianping. Or he would realize that he was being a jerk a lot of the time. So our next character, the elder teacher, Si Yuan, we don't know much about him, except that he is elder and that he seems to know pretty well how to handle Tianping. And what he doesn't do is meet Tianping on his own ground. He doesn't start a Dharma combat with him. He lets that go by, but he waits till Tianping isn't really expecting, isn't girded up for intellectual combat, and just calls out to him. He calls him by his second name, Song Yi. Come here, Song Yi. Tianping raised his head. Tianping is not sure what to do. He's surprised. Si Yuan said, wrong. What has Si Yuan realized about Tianping? And I mentioned that Tianping is a person who, as I understand the koan, is overly invested in the intellect, in the school mind, and has insufficiently cultivated the heart mind. But I also get the sense that Tianping is someone who is really, really obsessed with being right, who is, as we sometimes say in Zen, a person of right and wrong. He needs to win these Dharma combats. He needs to be right. This is probably an old habit of his. And I want to read a few lines from Chenul, which we encountered during the sutra service just now. to which is helping me think about how someone with some understanding, which Tianping clearly has, or he wouldn't be out doing these Dharma combats and wouldn't eventually end up in habit, how he could still be doing this. And so Chunul talks about gradual awakening, gradual cultivation, and says, although people have awakened to the fact that their original nature is no different from that of all the Buddhas, although you can have some awakening experience, the beginningless habit energies are extremely difficult to remove suddenly. And so they must continue cultivation while relying on this awakening. Sometimes we speak of this process as integration in Zen. So lots of beginningless habit energies to work with and work through. This phrase has been really important to me for years, beginningless habit energies, for a couple of reasons. And one is that the word, our word habit is a noun, but habits are much more verbs than nouns. They are things that we do. They are things that are going on in us. And habit energies, you know, two nouns, but habit energies, I think, gives habit that verbal force, helps us see that habits are processes that we get caught up in. And that we get caught up in again and again and again. And so Tianping has the habit energy of being right. Beginningless because we don't try to trace these things back to a primal scene. They may go back to the generation before us. They may go back to all human generations, some of our habit energies that we need to deal with. We don't need to analyze them. We just need to learn how to work with and through them. And I believe that this is what Si Yuan is offering Tianping in our poem. So wrong. Let's get Tianping where he lives. Let's touch the place in Tianping that's most tender and most vulnerable. His need to be right. His dualistic notions of right and wrong. I'm always right. They're always wrong. I always win. They always lose. This is a huge problem. Tianping went on for two or three steps. Si Yuan said, wrong. There's no place you can move, in effect, Si Yuan is saying to Tianping. No tricks are going to work this time. Tianping isn't even self-possessed enough at this point to try any of his usual tricks. He's just moving around kind of aimlessly. This is potentially a moment of real transformation for Tianping. This is a chance for Tianping to really get further along in his process of realization. And realization is not something that happens in a flash and is done, as Chunul is teaching us. It goes on and on. It's never done, this process. Tianping seems to think that it is. Si Yuan now almost is tormenting a little bit. I believe Si Yuan has his heart in the right place, but is he taking it too far? I've just said wrong twice. It is I who am wrong, or is it you? Really offering Tianping this little temptation to say, oh, maybe I wasn't wrong, to fall into that trap. But I think Tianping is just too confused at this point. And so he says, it's I'm the one who's wrong. Still a person of right and wrong. From having to be right all the time, now he has to be wrong. He can't seem to see his way past this dualism. Wrong. Tianping was silent. Now, nothing more to say. Nothing he can do. And then this amazing offer from Si Yuan: stay here for the summer retreat. So the Chinese monasteries had one major retreat in the summer that might last for a couple of months. We have a retreat here now that lasts for 3 weeks. if you want to do the full 3 weeks. And this is an important time to work through, to work with whatever is blocking you, whatever is coming up for you. Important time to deepen your practice, to deepen your realization. And the implication is that Tianping may have some kind of accreditation, may have some kind of claim to understanding, but he's not done. And he could really stand to spend some weeks, some months with a teacher like Siwan. Siwan is being the bodhisattva of compassion here. Stay here for the summer retreat. Stay here with me. And I'll examine the question of two wrongs with you. Not meaning I'm just going to keep knocking this into your head, but really, let's see where this comes from, this need to be right. Let's see where this comes from, this fear of being wrong. Let's see where this comes from, this inability to get beyond right and wrong. Tianping, however, departed. Years later, so we sometimes get these flash forwards in koans. Years later, when Tianping became an abbot, so now he does have his own assembly. He has his own monastery somewhere. He addressed his assembly and said, "Once in my days of pilgrimage, I visited Siyuan by chance." Another translation says he says this often. So Tianping knew something happened that was really important. He's carried this with him for however many years it's been. Maybe he's in his 60s now. And all these years, this has stayed with him, this offer from Siyuan, this experience, this being caught up short. He addresses assembly and said, "Once in my days of pilgrimage, of wandering, I visited Siwan by chance, and he twice said wrong. He advised me to stay with him for the summer retreat to examine this question of two wrongs with him. I don't say I was wrong then." That's interesting. We're not sure what he means. Does he mean that he was, he won't say he was wrong to leave and not stay for the 2 weeks? Is he saying that he won't say he was wrong when Siyuan was shouting wrong at him? We can leave that open for now. Be interesting to see what people feel. "But when I left for the South, I realized for the first time that I had finished saying wrong." Now, not every translation of this koan is as kind at this point. Sometimes it just makes it seem as though he learned nothing. This translation I like, because it opens the possibility pretty strongly that Tianping did learn something, at least learn that it was not helping him to go around saying that he was always right and the other person was always wrong. Siyuan saying wrong, 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 turns out to be holding a mirror up to Tianping in this version of the koan. Letting Tianping see how he comes off, letting Tianping see his own obsession with rightness and wrongness. And as this koan ends in this translation, Tianping takes that with him. Maybe that was transformational for him, though not as transformational as it would have been for him to spend the summer retreat with Siwan. One of the wonderful things about Sishin is that we have lots and lots of chances to be wrong. We have lots and lots of chances to confront our own investment in right and wrong. Just now, I did something wrong in the bowing, which luckily only the teachers could see. Just now, something went a little bit wrong with the bell, which we all got to hear. Things have been going wrong all day, and they'll go wrong all Sishin. This is not a bug. This is a feature of Sishin. We give ourselves lots of opportunities to mangle the forms, to miss cues, to do things wrong, so that we can confront
our own investment in being the one who knows, in being the one who's got it down, in being the old hand, whatever it is for you. We get to keep being reminded that no matter how many times we do sesshin, we can still get the spoon right side up when it's supposed to be upside down. We can still start untying our Oryoki set before it's time, and so on. Forget to bow when we're not supposed to. This is a rich field for confronting our own investment in being people of right and wrong. I know how it feels to hate being wrong. A lot of my life was spent hating to be wrong. I hated to be caught up in a mistake and doing something wrong. And you know, Chenul talks about this cultivating realization as a process of growing up. And Tianping seems to be caught in a kind of early adolescent phase. I know, Dad, where if you call out the wrong, that's the response you get. But actually, you know, in my experience and others I've noticed, we're quite capable of bringing those adolescent attitudes well into adulthood. Maybe in some ways, they never entirely disappear. This not wanting to be called out when we're wrong, this not wanting to accept correction, and the offer to sit with and be with the mistake, the error, the wrong. I remember once met a sesshin a number of years ago. I was serving as Jiki, as Jenny is now. So I was sitting up near the teachers. And at that time, I was determined never to sit in a chair and as much as possible to sit in quarter lotus posture. I thought that this was important. And as a result, I was often in a lot of pain. And during meal service, if I would finish a little bit early, which I often did, maybe for this reason I would eat fast, I'm not sure. I would unknot my legs and open up either my left or right leg and sort of have the foot sitting down in front of me on the floor. And because I was right near the teachers, this was noticed. And so one of the sesshin teachers took me aside and said, you know, when we're doing Oryoki, the floor becomes our table. And so it's really not appropriate to put your foot on the floor where we're eating. And I'll be honest and say my initial reaction was to want to say, right, because God forbid anyone should put their foot on the floor. But I didn't say that. I had just enough wisdom to bow to that. And then as I sat with that, what opened up to me was how wonderful it is that the floor can become the table, and that something we walk on during kinhin suddenly is not appropriate to touch with your foot. I appreciated how categories can dissolve like this, and floor can become table, foot can go from something that's innocently on the floor to something that shouldn't be on the floor but should stay on the zabuton, and realizing that everything was this way. And when we do sesshin, so much changes, so much is transformed. The way we sit, where we can direct our eyes, when and how we speak, many, many opportunities to realize that we can notice and overcome our habit energies. Because after all, it's a habit energy to think that it's always okay to put your foot on the floor because floors are made for feet to walk on. Well, not always. It's a habit energy to think that you can look around the zendo and see how other people are doing, because eyes seem to be made for looking around. That's a big way that as social animals, we manage our social environment is by looking at other people's faces and see if we can figure out what they're thinking, what they're intending, what they're feeling. And to let all that go, really dealing with that habit energy, and so on, throughout so many aspects of Sesshin. So this is our great opportunity to, at least for a couple of days, continue in this retreat together, continue to examine in ourselves this matter of right and wrong, this need to be right, and also this temptation of going to an intellectual understanding of Zen rather than an embodied understanding, rather than really let this permeate our bodies, really practice with our hearts, really practice with our guts, which often are smarter than our mouths. I don't know if you've had this experience. I've had it too many times, of starting to say something and feeling so wrong in the gut, and knowing that it's not something I should say. And it took me too many years to learn to just shut up at that moment because of my own beginningless habit energies. We can use a fancy word and say, listening to the hara, but we can also just say listening to our guts, listening to and with our hearts, opening ourselves up, mind and body, to the way. Well, on pilgrimage, Tianping visited Siwan. He was always saying, "Don't say you have understood Buddhism. There's no one who can have a Dharma dialogue with me or examine me." One day, Siwan saw him at a distance and called to him, "Come here, Sanyi." Tianping raised his head. Siwan said, "Wrong." Tianping went on for two or three steps. Siwan said, "Wrong." Tianping turned and came closer. Siwan said, "I've just said wrong twice. Is it I who am wrong, or is it you?" "It's I." "Wrong." Tianping was silent. "Stay here for the summer retreat, and I'll examine this question of two wrongs with you." Tianping, however, departed. Years later, when Tianping became an abbot, he addressed his assembly and said, "Once in my days of pilgrimage, I visited Siwan by chance, and he twice said wrong. He advised me to stay with him for the summer retreat to examine this question of two wrongs with him. I don't say I was wrong then, but when I left for the South, I realized for the first time that I had finished saying wrong." Thank you. So please sit comfortably and make a U at the end of the zendo. And we'll move into Dharma dialogue together. If you're on screen, please raise your Zoom hand. And if you're on a Zafu in the Zendo, raise your physical hand. And please come forward so that we can all of us, and David and Melissa will help me with this, so that we can all of us examine this matter together. Yeah, Vix.
There's the microphone. Yes.
So one thing that's coming up for me in the way that the younger character is talking about how he thinks that he knows things, is that I have recently caught myself in the pattern of thinking that I know things, because I've had like X or Y insight or experience, or I've been practicing Zen for this long and or whatever. But realizing that those are gone now, and I'm just as much a fish out of water as I was beforehand, and they can't really help me at this point.
Yeah, and I really appreciate the way that you are feeling compassionate towards Tianping, doing this identification. And I also want to say, not right back where you were before. Something has happened. And I think, I'm trying to be charitably, something happened for Tianping. And your openness to not staying satisfied with whatever openings you felt is really, really important. And it's what Tianping is missing, at least at the beginning of the koan.
And looking at what Chanul writes about gradual cultivation, he talks about these beginningless habit energies, but also invites us to rely on our awakening, which is different from holding on to it and saying, I know. But just like Alan was saying, so we are changed. And of course, many traps in that. To rely on something present every moment, and it's not the story of what happened, and it's not the new definition of I am this, but to realize that we are changed and touched, and there is something there. Thanks.
Yes, Susan.
Thank you, Alan, for this very, very rich talk. So many things were arising for me. First of all, when you were talking about being on pilgrimage, I have never seen myself being on pilgrimage when I see the different teachers in Boundless Way Zen. And this was very helpful for me. So first of all, thank you for that. And then you said at some point, and I don't know exactly your words, on the line beyond duality, something like this. So, and last night you were encouraging us in the Dharma dialogue to speak about what is touching us when we listen to a talk or so. And what was coming up for me that this morning when I watched the video from last night, and Paul mentioned in one of his instruction, you matter. He used this word, you matter, in terms of being 10 minutes before. Yeah, I don't know. So, and when I heard this, I was bursting in tears because, in terms of the duality I'm carrying for a long, long period of time, not long, long, but for a couple of years plus, the sentence that I don't matter. And this is very painful. And it was, and it came from a very deep place. And I'm sharing this now in this context that there is the duality. So you matter, or I matter, and a sense of I just don't matter. And seeing this arising, and I could go on, but I stop here now. So thank you so much for me, really a very, very, very deep talk you were offering. Thank you, Alan.
Yeah, thank you, Susan. And thank you for demonstrating this way of working with the heart. So not an intellectual response, but a response with the heart, and your response to Paul's words, right, which touched on another common human habit energy, which is thinking that we don't matter. You're not alone in that, although it may have been strong with you. And I'm sure it's been strong with some of us here. And then not fleeing from that, but just going straight into it with your heart open and your vulnerability cast aside. Your vulnerability open as well. And this is the way to practice.
Yeah, I'm not adding to what Alan said, but moving it in a slightly different direction. And I also appreciate what you're saying, seeing mattering and not mattering as a duality. I love that you're pointing that out. And of course, what teachers have to do when we see somebody leaning too much into one side of a duality is to bring them to the other side, right? To help them, which is just what Shi Yuan is doing with his teaching, as far as I'm concerned. So Tianping is really stuck in being right. He knows better than everybody else. So what does a teacher do with someone like that? He says wrong 3 times. Now, if he had come in and said, and there are koans where people come in and say things like this, I'm worthless. I'm just the worst Zen student in the world. And there's some famous ones that start that way. Then the teacher needs to pull in the other direction. No, you really matter. That's not a place you want to lean into. So this is what we're constantly doing until, Alan used the word in the talk, until we begin to integrate the two sides of ourselves, right and wrong, mattering, not mattering, without letting go of either one, right? Then that cannot be done intellectually. It's the only way to do it is through the body and the heart. So you coming forward like this, as Alan says, demonstration, and watch how you might get stuck in one thing or the other. Don't try to unstick yourself, but just notice, I'm really stuck in this duality on one side. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, Michael.
Thank you for your talk, Alan. And thank you. I really appreciate your response to Bix, both you and David, and bringing up the gradual cultivation. As we live our life, our view changes. And this is sort of an example. During your talk, Pierce said that he couldn't hear you. And Melissa asked if everything was okay. And I glanced over and I said, yeah, everything's okay. But now as I've shifted my position and look different, I'm looking at the microphone is totally wrong. It should be up. You should be speaking into the side of it. And there's a little blue tape that should be facing your mouth.
Like this.
There you go. Okay. So that in the future, but just by
500 lives as a fox.
Right. But the thing is that when I first looked over, I mean, my view changes constantly. And so that all is part of that gradual cultivation.
Yeah.
Appreciating that and also appreciating these habit energies. I think, as Alan said, habit energies are not a bug, they are a feature. And that we progress, we come into ourself, come into our life, come into awakening, not through our brilliance and wisdom, but through our habit energies, through our endless jerkiness,
how we all get stuck again and again. These are the rich, wonderful places that the path of Zen is not about overcoming them. I guarantee you will never not be a jerk. But the great thing is that if being a jerk is a resource, then we're all in great shape. Lots of rocket fuel to work with.
I love this example of the blue tape as a thing that I didn't know about the blue tape. I don't know how many people know about the blue tape, but when I was younger, I made sure that I could accumulate as much knowledge as possible about everything I encountered. That may have been because I was the youngest child in a family of really smart older people. But who knows psychologically why that's true. I think I loved when, Alan, what you were saying about Sasheen is such a great ground for looking into these habit energies, because there's all this stuff you probably don't know. You can't know it. And then somebody comes along and says, you know, we always put the mukha gyo with the mouth out in front of us, not to the side. But you might not know that. We always put the blue tape towards the speaker, but you might not know that. And then somebody comes along and says, blue tape, mouth to the front. And we can get lost in, oh, I just need to learn more about this stuff. But that's not ever going to happen. There's too many things like that. And I think, as Michael said, the view keeps changing. So I thought I knew how to set up that microphone. I really did. I'm like Tian Ping in that way. But blue tape. And then I'll clutch that blue tape. And then maybe, you know, those of us who know about the blue tape, it's a secret teaching. And we'll, do you see what we do? This is what human beings do. It's so great. And I just know that sometime in the future, this microphone will not have that blue tape, and it'll be a whole different thing again. And we'll have a different instrument for the rhythm. And so there, you could try to hold on tight. But the real teaching is to keep your hand open, and the knowledge comes through and you go, oh, and then what more can I learn? What more can I learn?
Rich.
Yeah. So my rocket fuel these days is in the kitchen with my partner, where I'm not a housemaker, and she is, and she's really good at it. And you're talking about being entrenched in being right. And I know that feeling, but this is more a feeling of, I've got to say I'm right, even though I kind of really know I'm wrong. And fortunately, it's a relationship where we can work that out, but it's so hard for me to just, you know, like, oh, I didn't know that, you know, I'm 7 years old. I didn't know how to line up dishes in the dishwasher. And then, like Melissa was saying, and then I start to do it that way. And I think that is the only way. And then she goes and does it another way. And of course, so it's great rocket fuel.
Yeah, daily life is quite wonderful, and seeing, of course, Sangha is quite wonderful, because when I'm by myself, I can imagine that I'm quite an equanimous fellow and quite fine with things going as they go. But then someone complains about, you know, crumbs on the counter or this or that, and suddenly I get to see the thing is, we're so conditioned. And usually we pretend that we're not, and we usually imagine, oh, yes, I'm a free person. If only my partner were as free as I was, then everything would be fine, or my Sangha mates. But getting to see this, getting to notice this, and Rich, you remind me, too, that, and I think it's what Melissa was saying, is that We can get stuck in being the one who knows. We can also get stuck in being the one who doesn't know. And then I am really committed. I just have no idea. I don't know how to be in the kitchen. I don't know how to be in the garden. And then we defend that identity. Can get stuck on either side when both are the case. Yeah, thanks, Rich.
Deb? Oh, yeah.
Thank you so much for the talk. It really resonated for me because I feel like right and wrong, I just noticed today, I was corrected about something this morning. And at first I go right to, oh, I'm a bad person. Like, you know, I did something wrong. And then I'm like, oh, wait, this is where we bow down. You know, there's that thing we read where we say, if someone says something to you, you bow down and that's what it's about. It's not, oh, sorry, I moved it away. My microwave. Anyway, I feel like I'm always wanting, it's such an old habit energy about wanting to be right. You know, and wanting to be good. And so it's just very helpful. That was a really helpful talk. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Speaking of mistakes, my very first few months in Boundless Way Zen, when I would hear those lines, you know, it's best to bow down. This is the Buddha appearing to us, finding ways to free us from our own attachments. I used to think it was, this is the Buddha appearing in us. And like, oh yeah, I'm going to be the Buddha now. And after a couple of months, I said, oh my God. and you know, there I was trying to do a kind of little ego thing with this, which was really about letting go of the ego and realizing that the person that not just kindly corrects you as it might've happened this morning, but is really nasty to you, nastily, you know, corrects you or blocks you, cuts you off in traffic, is the Buddha appearing to you. And that's quite an amazing way to approach life. Matt.
Thanks so much for the talk, Alan. Like a lot of these koans, when I first hear them, I'm kind of like, huh? I just really appreciated the way you entered into it, and just such rich territory as someone who, you know, very attached to being right, as a way often, and I can't speak for the young person in the koan, but you know, a way to manage a deeper sense of being defective, of being wrong, you know, like, so I'm going to be right. And as Deb would know, I do know how to load the dishwasher, and I'm not afraid to say so, you know, just as an example. I didn't hear the end of the koan until the last time you read it. I didn't quite understand that line, and maybe I don't have it now, but what I heard you say was, I was done with saying wrong. And there's something that just really touched me about that, because I hear also, I'm done with saying right, you know, I'm done with this. And again, I'm not sure if I heard it right the last time either, but that's very powerful. Anyway, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Matt. And, you know, it's interesting. We haven't heard from anybody yet who said, yeah, I don't have this thing about right and wrong. I think this, is, you know, this is something that we all share, and I appreciate the different ways that people have spoken to it.
I was just going to say that it, Matt, it doesn't really matter whether you heard it right. Right, we have to really value our own perception of these koans and the koan cafes. That's what it's all about. Whatever you are experiencing, we say that even a bad Dharma talk, if it's heard well, it redeems it. Right, and so even a really confusing koan, the way you perceive it, is the most important thing. So maybe, you know, your inner Tian Ping had a revelation there, and that's what matters.
And
yeah, I don't know if I agree with myself in the 5 minutes I've been thinking about this, but I'll go ahead anyway. Zen seems to me, more than any other endeavor I've been in, to have right and wrong ways of doing things. I'm probably thinking about that wrong, but everything else, someone said, here, figure it out and tell me how you figured it out. I know we're not supposed to think we're right or wrong, but there is a right and wrong way of putting the spoon or putting the thing. And it seems, unless the right and wrong Zen is providing are just arbitrary to teach us not to think about right and wrong, it's just a random thing, that could be. But it seems to say we don't believe in dichotomies when there's so damn many dichotomies in everything we do. That's my problem.
Well, of course there's a right way to do things. But in some ways, everything we do here is a kind of convention. Someone will say, well, what does this really mean? Like, we don't really know. I mean, we can point to things. Why do we bow? Why do we walk this way instead of that way? And in some ways, as human beings, these are conventions that allow us to do this formless work. Melissa and I were members of an improvisational dance company many years ago. And twice a week, we would get together with other members of the company to do nothing. You know, we would move around and do this and that, but we were practicing unstructured time. But we had to structure it to be able to practice the unstructure of it. How do you practice improvisation? Well, you've got to set aside time, and there's a beginning and there's an end. Well, that's not improvisational. That's, you know, you're setting it up. So there are all these forms. And I think Alan talked about it last night. The freedom that these forms allow, because they create a place where we can be wild, where we don't have to figure out, it's odd, where we don't have to figure out what we're supposed to do. You're supposed to sit still, right? Well, what am I supposed to do? Sit still, breathe in and breathe out, see what happens, right? The simplest thing, but usually we're so thinking about, well, what's next? And So all of these forms are arbitrary, and all of them are designed to create this space where we get to look in some new way. So yes, there is a correct place to put your spoon, and we will let you know if you don't put it there. It's just, and there are no mistakes. Sometimes in the officers' meetings, as we're beginning, my favorite thing to say is we're starting and everybody's looking, what happens here? What happens here? And I like to say, all right, no mistakes, right? And that way, you know, let's do it as elegantly as we can. And whatever happens, it was not a mistake for Tianlong to leave. It got him exactly where he needed to go.
Well, I'm so glad you brought this up, Anne, too, because you're probably not the only person who feels this way. And again, it's the blue tape, right? And the mouth of the mukugyo go, how do you know these things? Well, then somebody comes along and tells you. But I always remember I had been a Zen student of another teacher for 20 years. And when I first started working in Boundless Way, 20 something more years ago, my first sesshin, I was given the job of jiki, the timekeeper and the leading the walking. And one of the leaders of the sesshin pulled me aside and explained to me all the things that I was doing wrong, especially in the walking. And, you know, I bowed to that Buddha. I knew by then, but I was like, a little confused, but I said, sure, I'll do it. Then the tanto of the sesshin, maybe it was the jisha. I think it was the jisha, the person who, they came over to me and they said, So I need to tell you that you're doing the walking all wrong. This is after I'd been practicing the way that the other person had told me. And I listened, and I tried. There was a real two wrongs, right? You were wrong, and then another person came along and said, and you were wrong, but in a different way. It was really confusing. And I remember coming, so I tried to find the middle way. And then got more negative feedback. And then I went to the teacher and I just poured out my heart to him. This was James Ford. And I was crying. And he said, pretty much like this koan. Yeah, yeah. Well, you're wrong. Figure it out. Right? Going back. You find your way. So it was like a little bit of being knocked back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And it's one of the reasons I'm continuously or continually, what's proper?
Continually.
Oh, continually. He's an English, he was a retired English professor. Continually grateful for the forms because they knock me around and I can't stay in certainty. And that has opened up incredible insights and joys and clarity that if I just thought, I got it, I'm going to just do this. I don't think I would have ever, it's been softened up like this. So it's a softening. It's my first teacher used to call it a polishing. There's a polishing of the heart mind. So so if you can work with the corrections, that's a really important thing in our Zen practice. And Sashin is just kind of constructed that way. So good luck.
Brad.
I'm thinking about the notion of pilgrimage. And it's the farthest thing from my mind in Zen practice. In my first Zen group, I never thought I'd ever go anywhere but there. And since joining Boundless Way, I expect to sit through my 70s and 80s and beyond. Am I missing something? should I be looking at, Tibetan Buddhist books or, what's the purpose of pilgrimage at a certain point in your practice, I guess? And is it something I shouldn't worry about? Because I'm kind of cozy where I am.
I would not discourage you from staying with us, Brad. And also, pilgrimage is a loaded word. The other translations, he says, when the wind was blowing me this way and that, which I kind of like, when I was on my wanderings. But you mentioned books, and one thing to think about in terms of ancient China is that there wouldn't have been books, or very many. There certainly weren't printed books in ancient China. So there wasn't, there wasn't YouTube videos and there et cetera. We have lots and lots of ways to encounter various teachings and teachers without literally going from place, packing a few things in our car and going from place to place. So I think that's part of the reason we don't talk about it so much. But if you want to read some Tibetan Buddhist books, go for it.
Yeah, Brad, I would suggest Tibetan Buddhism for you. I love what Susan said about the pilgrimage. One of the features of our school is that you're going to get different responses from different teachers, seeing it this way and seeing it that way, and great value. There's not just one person here. I guess for me on the, there was the social milieu and how Zen fit into the culture in ancient China, which is quite different than here. I think this idea of pilgrimage for me is, every time we come to Sashin, we're on pilgrimage. You're on pilgrimage now. You have left home.
And we leave home and we're blown about by the karmic forces of our life as we sit on the cushion. And how to be a good pilgrim. Look, you know, from coming home and leaving home at the same time. So for me, that idea is not so much we can get lost in finding the right YouTube video and I'm going to listen to all of, you know, Reb Anderson's thing or all of David's thing or whatever. But I think that misses the point. The real pilgrimage is breathing in and breathing out, not getting stuck in some one-sided view.
And here's another view. I don't disagree with anything that's been said, but I want to just pull this in. There is a trajectory to our lives, especially when we find the spiritual energy moving in us and the desire to know something about beyond what I call consensual reality. And it's in Zen, we call it bodhicitta. It's like the force of awakening. It awakens in us and we start looking. And so at the beginning of practice, always there's the wandering. There's reading this book and that book and going to this retreat center and that retreat center. And it's really true. I'd never thought of it till Susan said it, that we provide a way to do that in a cozier situation where you just go to keep getting different teachers in Doksan. And so there's also at a certain point, I've seen it happen. It happened to me. I've seen it happen to other people. There's, I just love your use of the word cozy, Brad. There's like a fit, you know, it's a good fit. I found a good fit and I decided to take the precepts. You know, I wanted to make a commitment to this way and it felt good. And then I've had two different teachers. I was with one teacher for a long time and then the second teacher for a long time. When I committed to the teacher, that's like another way of saying, yep, I'm in. I want to learn from you. It didn't mean that I didn't go elsewhere, but what it meant was that I had a path that was fairly clear. I mean, I can't really say Zen's that clear, but that I could compare these other things to. So when I did Tibetan retreats or Vipassana retreats, I could see where there were overlaps and it was delightful. And then I just kept going home over and over and over and over again. And when I left my first teacher, it was wrenching, but then finding a new home, settling in again. Some of us ordain as priests. I mean, so you can take the precepts, you can commit to a teacher in Shokan, you can ordain. These are real commitments, but then you can also say, nope, not anymore. They're not like forever. And that's important too. So the wandering goes on forever, really. But if all we do is wander, I get concerned in the great spiritual supermarket of today that you could be on YouTube constantly, right? You could be listening to talks from hundreds of people. And some people do that. I'm not sure it's such a great idea if you haven't firmly established your cozy base yet. So that's what I would suggest to not be too tight and not be too loose, but see what you're doing as just being here at Sesshin is a huge expression of commitment. Everyone on screen and here. And that's why everybody matters.
Let's do one more. Laura.
I was kind of thinking about as you were reading this, like it was like hot potato with right and wrong, which I feel like happens a lot in the world. Like everyone is kind of playing hot potato with shame or blame or being right or wrong. And the visual that I loved about the younger one was I kind of pictured him just taking the two wrongs and placing them in his pocket and just kind of walking off. And not that it was kind of this like surrendered in a kind of shameful way, but just in this kind of walking off, like first he comes in so right and then gets these wrongs and then receives them as if they're his. And then another wrong, and then an invitation to like right these wrongs, or maybe not even, but to examine them. And then the examination was to just walk. And that just kind of touched me, you know.
I love you mentioning shame, and in some ways, it's a way that to solidify the ego, right? We fall into shame, and it's a very solid identity. I am the terrible one, or you know, and so I love this, you know, just putting the wrongs in your pocket. Okay, I don't understand. Doesn't make sense, and not going either way with them. And clearly in his pocket, they did what they needed to. And so to a kind of holding more loosely, right? Yeah. Oh, well, that person really thought I did a terrible job. Well, that's interesting. Let's see what happens next time. Oh, wonderful. Thanks, Lara.
Thank you, everyone.